Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Pfeffer, the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Previously, he worked as the associate editor of World Policy Journal and has been an international affairs representative in Eastern Europe and East Asia for the American Friends Services Committee and a Pan-Tech Fellow in Korean Studies at Stanford University. He's also taught at Sung Kong Hyo University in Seoul, South Korea, and his books include Crusade 2.0, The Future of U.S.-Korean Relations, The Imbalance of Power, and North Korea-South Korea, U.S. Policy at a Time of Crisis. Thank you for joining us, John Pfeffer.
Thanks for having me on your show.
And this nukes for food deal that is in the offing between North Korea and the United States. We've to some extent, we've been there before. What's different about this, do you think?
Well, there are a couple of differences. The first is, of course, that we have a different political leadership in North Korea. It's Kim Jong-un, the youngest son of Kim Jong-il, who died at the end of 2011. And we have a somewhat different political configuration here in the United States as well, since, of course, we really haven't had any agreements between North Korea and the United States during the Obama administration. We have a new envoy, Glenn Davies, who was negotiating this particular agreement. So, to a certain extent, both sides can say, hey, you know, we're a clean slate here. Let's try something new, even if what we're trying sounds a lot like what we did before.
So this deal involves a package of 240,000 metric tons of food assistance to North Korea. And Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton, in announcing it, said that there will be intensive monitoring of the aid, which I take it is reflects a concern that food aid might go to the military instead of the starving civilians in North Korea.
There has been that concern in the past. Certainly the United States has insisted repeatedly on very strict monitoring of food assistance. There have been challenges in the past that have been laid at the doorstep of North Korea about diversion of food aid, both to the military as well as to the kind of the political leadership. But, you know, I would say a couple of things. Number one, that there's always what's called basically shrinkage or slippage in food assistance anywhere in the world. Sometimes the food ends up on markets, and that certainly has been the case in North Korea. Sometimes it doesn't end up with the neediest people. But for the most part, food assistance that has gone to North Korea has been pretty well monitored when it's gone through the UN food program. Some of the bilateral assistance, on the other hand, bilateral assistance coming from particularly China, is not monitored. So there's really no reason for North Korea to divert food assistance that comes with monitoring requirements when it can basically distribute the food that comes from China anywhere it pleases.
Again, I'm speaking with John Pfeffer, the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus. He has been a Pan-Tech Fellow in Korean Studies at Stanford University and has taught at Sung Kong Hyo University in Seoul, South Korea, and is the author of North Korea, South Korea, U.S. Policy at a Time of Crisis. Do you think then, John Pfeffer, that this agreement will lead to the broader six-nation negotiations resuming?
Well, it's possible. I think, frankly, this agreement is in many ways better than an opening round in the six-party talks. Opening rounds and six-party talks generally are just an opportunity for the six countries to make statements, test each other out. It takes a long time for these negotiations to actually produce agreements. But here we have North Korea saying that it'll suspend its uranium production and also suspend its nuclear and missile tests. And I think that's a very important step forward. So if the six parties can build on that momentum, then we might have a much shorter period of time before we get to the next stage in this process.
But it's always been pretty much the North Korean position that they want to deal directly with the United States. And in many ways, they see themselves for their own internal consumption, in spite of the fact that it's an impoverished country that can't feed itself. The people believe that they are standing up to the United States, and the government propaganda is relentlessly portrays the South Korean regime as puppets of the United States who aren't even worth talking to. So I take it that dealing directly with the United States is an important part of North Korean strategy.
Oh, absolutely. And it's not simply because, you know, North Korea wants to present to the people that it's standing up to the United States. It's a very pragmatic kind of analysis of geopolitics. North Korea looks around and says, hey, who's the strongest country in the world? Well, the United States is. It's the primary military superpower in the world. China is nowhere near the United States in terms of its military strength, even though China, of course, is a neighbor of North Korea and sometimes ally of North Korea. So North Korea is saying to itself, well, how do we get out of our predicament? Our predicament being basically economic underdevelopment. We're in a kind of politically challenging situation with a political succession that has just taken place. We have some problematic relations right now with Japan and South Korea. Really, we have to deal with the United States. The United States holds the key in terms of unlocking the dilemma of Northeast Asia. Whatever the United States says, South Korea and Japan are going to follow suit. So I think that's really what North Korea's strategic thinking is at the moment.
Again, I'm speaking with John Pfeffer, the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus. He was a Pantech Fellow in Korean Studies at Stanford University and has taught at Sungkyunkwan University in Seoul, South Korea. And his books include Crusade 2.0, The Future of U.S.-Korean Relations, The Imbalance of Power, and North Korea, South Korea, U.S. Policy at a Time of Crisis. So given that we've seen this before, that these food for nukes deals, and the U.S. was supposed to supply also supplement the energy needs of North Korea with fuel. They agreed to shut down the reactor. Then they turned out they had another route to the bomb as well. The same reactor that they'd agreed to shut down, now they are agreeing to shut down again in exchange for this 240,000 metric tons. And they, of course, had tested a nuclear weapon. There's some doubt exactly what they have. The first test was a bit of a dud. The second one seemed to have worked. It's quite possible that they actually have a fairly advanced design for a nuclear warhead that could fit on a missile. They've also had missile tests in 2009 that provoked UN sanctions. Then in 2010, of course, they unveiled an uranium enrichment facility, giving them a second route to a bomb. The long and the short of it is, John, that it seems to me if they're prepared to give up their nuclear program, which of course, you know, obviously the Iranians, the whole world is coming down in Iran over theirs and the extent to which they've declared what they're doing, it seems in many ways that the whole thing has been a bargaining chip all along. Is that possible?
Well, I think that North Korea developed its nuclear weapons for a variety of reasons. One was because they saw nuclear weapons as a status symbol that would indicate to the population and to the world at large that North Korea was a developed nation. I think also that North Korea felt that nuclear weapons served as an important deterrent, especially when, relatively speaking, its conventional strength was deteriorating in comparison to South Korea, and certainly in comparison with the United States and with Japan, that it had to pull some rabbit out of the hat in order to prevent the United States or any other country that might think about regime change through intervention in North Korea from going forward with such a plan. So I think those are two key reasons. A third one, of course, is the relationship between nuclear power and nuclear energy. I mean, you can obviously pursue a civilian nuclear program up to a certain point without going nuclear, and that was an important kind of energy source for North Korea as well, since it only has coal. It doesn't really have any other energy sources, and so nuclear was an important kind of way of becoming independent in an energy sense. So before we even get to the issue of whether, you know, the nuclear program is a useful bargaining chip, I think the nuclear program did serve those other purposes. Now, of course, North Korea realized as well that the only reason that countries like the United States were going to pay attention to it, especially after the fall of the Soviet Union and China's kind of decision to move into the global capitalist economy, was if it had a nuclear weapon, that there were plenty of countries around the world that the United States might not like but would pay no attention to because they simply had nothing that the United States needed or didn't pose a threat to the United States. And the nuclear weapon, of course, posed such a threat. And once they kind of discovered this, they realized that this nuclear program could be a useful bargaining chip. And, you know, this came about roughly around the time that the country plunged into a famine in the mid-1990s. And so then the nuclear program becomes a bargaining chip, not only to attract U.S. attention, but to serve as a kind of a ticket, a golden ticket that North Korea could cash in order to kind of jumpstart its economy and leapfrog, in its mind, over, you know, its current travails and leapfrog into kind of modern capitalist economy. So I think that's kind of the strategic thinking around the nuclear program in Pyongyang.
Well, that, you know, they've done some fairly outrageous things, fairly recently sinking a North Korean ship and shelling a South Korean ship and shelling a South Korean island, which certainly, you know, even though there's a lot of sympathy in the South for the North Korean brethren, that was, the second incident was quite shocking. The first incident, some people in the South still don't believe it. There's a pattern here. Is that what? Just in closing, what you're suggesting that they do things that are designed to reward them for bad behavior?
Well, you know, there is certainly a tendency to see North Korea as simply kind of behaving irrationally or behaving, you know, in a unacceptable way. But we also have to realize that we've kind of put North Korea into that position, that we, you know, really haven't given it any kind of carrots, any kind of significant outlays of resources in response to good behavior. You know, we've basically ignored North Korea for the most part, and we've insisted that it make its reforms unilaterally without any promise that we'd, you know, help them if they moved in a particular direction. Mm-hmm. And so from North Korea's point of view, it really doesn't have much of a choice. It can only behave badly in order to attract international attention, to attract U.S. attention. Only bad behavior elicits any kind of response. And that seems to be the case with South Korea as well in the past. So, you know, mm-hmm. Ideally, this current deal will kind of change that logic around, and that we will have, you know, a tendency to provide good for good. In other words, further carrots for further kind of changes in North Korean behavior. That hopefully will change the dynamic.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us today, John Pfeffer.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Again, I've been speaking with John Pfeffer, the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, previously worked as the associate editor of World Policy Journal and has been an international affairs representative in Eastern Europe and East Asia for the American Friends Service Committee. He's been a Pantech Fellow in Korean Studies at Stanford University and has taught at Sungkyunkyo University in Seoul, South Korea, and his books include Crusade 2.0, The Future of U.S.-Korean Relations, The Imbalance of Power, and North Korea-South Korea, U.S. Policy at a Time of Crisis. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Chris Scheid. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Time.